May it please the court, counsel. If the decision of the agency below...
Counsel, would you please enter an appearance or tell us your name? And
sure. My name is Chris Engold, bar number 28684, appearing on behalf of Carolina Gonzalez, the appellant.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. If the decision of the agency below is permitted by this court to stand, there will be more litigation of this type. If the principle of stare decisis were observed by the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, which in a quasi-judicial fashion they have observed in the past, and that many times you'd get an order from the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, and it would cite a prior case, a prior interpretation of the law, and it'd say, you know, we see no reason to deviate from our prior determinations, and then they would apply the determinations of law as they had determined them in the past. So, in essence, the agency did practice stare decisis. If it practiced that same custom in this case, we wouldn't be here. The Rainbow case, which was cited in the petition to review brief, the Hildebrandt case, a host of other cases that went before the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, they didn't permit this, what has occurred here, which is to decide a substantive matter on a procedural motion. And this procedural motion wasn't even a motion for summary judgment, which required a different process under the rules adopted by the Office of Administrative Courts. It was a motion to dismiss. So it was in lockstep with the prior cases decided by the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, Rainbow Bread, Hildebrandt, all of which said, if you don't have a hearing, you can't decide substantive matters on a procedural motion.
Were those cases, are not binding on us, right?
Oh, no, which is why they weren't cited, because they're not binding.
Fine. Were those cases that involved discovery sanctions, or were they other types of cases?
There were at least some discovery sanction cases. I can't recall whether they were all discovery sanction cases or whether they included other matters as well. But in essence, what you're looking at is the statute says that the administrative law judges are empowered to make a whole host of decisions, including applying sanctions under Rule 37 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. However, it's in connection with a hearing. So, for example, in the Sheed versus Hewlett-Packard case, which is cited by the appellee because it seems to support their position, there were at least four hearings set in the Sheed versus Hewlett-Packard case, and at least one appearance of the claimant in person before the administrative law judge. So the facts of the Sheed case don't go against the basic rule that was adopted by the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, which is you can't decide substantive matters or dispositive matters based on a procedural motion.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Engold, if I may, please. I want to talk a little bit about the statute, 843-207.
Yes.
Would you agree with me that that statute lists under its many lettered subsections certain things that ALJs can and often should resolve without holding a hearing?
If a hearing has been set, there are matters they can decide.
Well, for example, the statute specifically talks about, and I understand that you think that this is substantive, but it specifically says that the ALJ could dispose of procedural requests upon written motion or on written briefs or oral arguments as determined appropriate. So at least in that instance, the legislature has made clear that the ALJ does not have to hold a hearing, right?
On procedural matters, I agree.
Okay. As you go through these things here, clearly there are others. For example, I don't think if an ALJ is holding a hearing, and he begins to administer an oath, I don't think he has to hold a hearing on the propriety of administering an oath. Would you agree with that?
I think that that was, that's a kind of order that would fold into the final order.
Okay.
Right, so it's part of the process.
So we basically come down to subsection P, which is the imposition of sanctions, right? Do you think that an ALJ always has to hold a hearing under this statute if he or she is going to impose sanctions under subsection N? Any sanction?
Yes, because of the phrase for willful failure. How can he decide whether it's willful failure unless he makes a finding of fact? How can he make a finding of fact unless he or she holds a hearing?
Well, often, you know, things can proceed by offer of proof. And what if the ALJ says, submit things to me, and I can make, based upon, which would allow me to make a finding of whether conduct was willful, and I'll proceed that way.
In essence, that sounds like a motion for summary judgment process where essentially the proponent, the movement, makes an offer of proof, lists out the facts that they believe are undisputed, and then what happens? The respondent, the person responding to the motion for summary judgment, says why the issues that are stated by the other side are in dispute or not in dispute. I suppose if there were facts that were not in dispute that allowed a legal resolution of the matter, that would be appropriate. But to the extent that facts are in dispute, not only in the workers' compensation system, but in district court as well, where facts are in dispute, a hearing must be held.
I'm trying to figure out how much of your argument is based on the statute and how much your argument is based on due process considerations, because I think that they can be viewed separately, can't they?
They can be viewed separately, except that where a process is specified by statute that is not followed, that's a clear due process violation, both substantively and procedurally. And that's the essence of this argument. It's not that the judge issued or abused his discretion. It goes beyond that. Of course there was abuse of discretion, because errors of law are an abuse of discretion. The judge, we don't even analyze abuse of discretion yet, although again, this is presented as an error of law where you don't consider lesser sanctions. Even in Shee versus Hewlett-Packard, the decision is careful to point out that the lesser sanctions were considered.
Did your opposition to the motion to dismiss suggest less severe sanctions?
Yes, in that there were two things that were filed. One was a motion for however much time the opposition needed to cure any prejudice, and describing the problems that resulted in it. It recited that what they had sought had already been provided. However, the proposed order...
Is there any indication? Excuse me, I'm sorry for interrupting you. But I wanted to ask you about the statement you just made that what they had wanted had already been provided. Is there any indication in the record?
Yes.
And where would that be? I was unable to find that.
Let me first say, I didn't receive the proposed order. And the proposed order, unsigned, does not appear in the record. The order in the record is the one signed by the judge. But if you look at this certificate line, and I recite this in the brief, there's this, and respondents' firms tend to do this. They tend to have a file number that they associate with each case. And so there at the certificate of mailing on the judge's order, which had to have been a proposed order, there's the respondent's proposed or the respondent's file number for this claim. So if you look at their motion and you look at the certificate of mailing line on the order, those file numbers match up. Orders don't get issued with claimant file numbers.
Well, what's the evidence?
I mean, we may be asking the same thing. What's the evidence that the discovery requests were ever complied with.
Well, in essence...
I assume that's what you were saying, that what they were wanting had already been produced.
Right. In essence, it's a confession in that it's never been denied. In the motion asking for time to cure and in responding to the motion to dismiss, the fact that the discovery has been provided, most of which was received from them, and other stuff that I've never received from them, employment records and whatnot, but anyway, they received everything, most of which had been received from them, was provided to them, that's recited in the response to the motion to dismiss and in the motion to, you know, one, cure whatever prejudice, and that's been recited in the, you know, the brief regarding the petition to review, the brief in this case, it's never been denied.
So you're
it won't be denied because it was provided.
So you're relying on your recitation and your pleadings that you had already provided it to prove that you had already provided it.
Well, exactly, and that's the problem with this case, isn't it? There are no findings of fact. There are no findings of fact in this case because there was no hearing held.
But you could have submitted an affidavit on all the facts that you're talking about.
Well,
I mean,
that's true. And, you know, however, an affidavit, trial by affidavit, is highly unsatisfactory. And so the fact that the motion went to the administrative law judge and the response went to the administrative law judge, and it recited that the discovery has been provided, and it asked for additional time to cure, and the statute requires that a hearing be held. If a hearing had been held, all of this stuff could have been waived. We don't even actually know what their prejudice is because there's no finding of fact on the prejudice. There's no finding of fact whatsoever because you can't have findings of fact without a hearing.
Was the ALJ right to be concerned that this case had gone dark for so long?
I think so, but who should he be concerned about? I mean, you have a claimant who was careful when she experienced occupational injury and distress from the occupational injury and aggravation from the occupational injury to report it to her employer, not once, but twice. And if you look through the record, is there a notice of contest? No, they simply ignored it. Now, again, at a hearing, we could argue about whether it's a no-loss-time claim. So they're not in violation of the statute because it was a no-loss-time claim. I would submit it. There was lost time. And they did have an obligation to take a position on the claims that she made to them, not once but twice.
Mr. Engel, I'm going to remind you that you have about 2 minutes left in the event you want to
say. I should probably reserve some time. If you don't have any other burning questions at this moment.
Okay.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Doug Stratton, registration number 28851. I am here on behalf of the respondents in this case, respondents in the underlying case or the employer. I would like to first point out Rule 91G of the Workers' Compensation Rules of Procedure, which states that once an order to compel has been issued and properly served upon the parties, failure to comply with the order shall be presumed willful. This statute
Pardon me, Mr. Stratton. I'm sorry for hitting you right out of the box.
That's fine.
But that's not any rebuttable presumption, is it?
No, that would be a rebuttable presumption, Your Honor. And it's also an embodiment of the case law, for instance, from Quickway, that states that a sufficient level of culpability for default will generally be found where there's a violation of an order compelling discovery. Now, I understand claimant's attorney's argument is that the statute requires a hearing. No, it does not. Section 843.207.1e and 1p allow an ALJ to impose sanctions when there's been a discovery violation or a violation of an order.
I agree, but where does it say, excuse me, where does it say they can do it without a hearing? I don't see that in.
Well, there's nowhere it says that there has to be a hearing.
Yes, there is. In the beginning of the statute, in the most sweeping imaginable language, it says, "Hearings shall be held to determine any controversy concerning any issue arising under Articles 40 to 47.
And then the
and then there are provisions that say, like G, that say, well, you don't need to do that when you're doing a purely procedural request. And maybe your contention is this was a procedural request. But I don't see anything in P that says you don't have to have a hearing.
Subsections,
so straighten me out.
Yeah, subsections E and P both refer to the rules of civil procedure that give the ALJ jurisdiction to impose sanctions under the rules of civil procedure. Rule 37 does not require a hearing.
Well, hold on, just one thought. First of all, P says impose the sanctions provided in Colorado rules of civil procedure. It doesn't say follow the procedures established in the Colorado rules of procedure. Can't that be read as simply saying whatever the sanctions are, they're listed in the Colorado rules of civil procedure, you can impose those pursuant to the procedures that are required in our workers' comp proceedings.
Yes, I would agree that the rules of procedure don't necessarily apply or don't generally apply in a workers' comp
situation. And in fact, Rule 37 doesn't say anything about whether you have to have a hearing or don't want to have a hearing, does it?
It does not.
You have to go to Rule 121.1-15 to find out that it's up to the judge in any motion to decide whether he wants to hear a hearing, right?
That's correct.
So how do you get there with these very slight references that there has to be a, that there doesn't have to be a hearing?
Section 843.207.1E states that a hearing shall be held to determine any controversy concerning any issue arising under the Act. The very next sentence states that in connection with hearings, and remember this was in connection with the hearing on denial of liability.
Which is what we're talking about.
Correct. In connection with hearings, ALJs are empowered to impose the sanctions provided in the rules of civil procedure for willful failure. There is no requirement for a hearing in that situation. The statute does not express a requirement for a hearing.
So, Mr. Stratton, just to make sure I understand your argument, the first sentence in subsection 1 sets out a broad general rule, right?
Correct.
Then your argument is that the second sentence, which begins with the clause in connection with hearings, right?
Correct.
That what that means is that those things don't have to be hearings because they are connected to hearings.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
If a hearing was required to resolve every dispute under the Workers' Compensation Act, the system would fail on its own statute. The system is set up to be an efficient system that's to be done without the necessity of litigation. Section 8-40-102 expresses this desire of the legislature to require a hearing before we can go to a hearing on the merits of the case, especially under the background of this case where there had been already 2.5 years before there was actually an application for hearing filed to dispute the denial of liability. The application for hearing in this case was not filed until after a motion to close had been filed. In other words, the claim had been stagnant for so long. The rules of procedure allow a party to move to close because these cases can be open indefinitely. Once the motion to close is filed, then the claimant decided to file an application for hearing to contest the merits of the case. That's the backdrop of this case. And then to add to that, a 6-month delay in responding to interrogatories and even the simple matter of providing a signed release was not given. Now, there was some discussion as to whether discovery was eventually provided. I will state that it was provided on January 3, 2014, which was 30 days or several, the motion to dismiss was filed on December 23, 2013. The discovery was finally provided, but it was only 1 month before the hearing was scheduled to occur. And under the statute, we are required to exchange medical records within 30 or 20 days of a hearing. By that point, we had 10 days to take these releases, send them out to the providers, get them back, and get them to the opposing counsel in 10 days. The damage had already been done.
Let me interrupt you there a moment. So you're saying that the discovery was produced. I'm hearing you say that. It was provided.
It was provided on January 3.
What you're saying is untimely. What I would like to know is, when was it provided in relation to the imposed sanction of dismissing the claims?
The motion to compel was, or the order compelling the discovery was October 24, 2013. Mm-hmm. And the actual motion to dismiss was in December 23, 2013. So the answers to interrogatory, the discovery was provided after the motion to dismiss.
But before the order, the ALJ's order entering the sanction of dismissal.
Correct. And I will point out that the claimant's attorney did state in his opposition to motion to dismiss that discovery had been provided, but there was no specific reference to the discovery, not even the date that it was provided. At the time the motion was filed, there had been no discovery, and it was already too late by the time we did get the discovery.
Let me ask you another question. How do you respond to Mr. Engel's claim that the ALJ could not make the necessary factual findings for reaching a conclusion about a proper sanction or about dismissing the claims without conducting a hearing?
A hearing is necessary when there are factual disputes or disputes and controversy. The undisputed facts in this case were more than sufficient to support the ALJ's finding that the judge's order compelling discovery had been violated, as well as the discovery obligations had been violated for 6 months. That does not change the facts. Those facts were not even disputed in the claimant's opposition to the motion to dismiss. The hearing that he's requesting is a hearing on whether he was too ill to provide these things. That required more than just an allegation. That required at least some support in the way of an affidavit, a doctor's note, something that would explain this 6 month delay.
Was that ever provided?
No. And the judge, the claimant's attorney didn't give the judge anything to base anything but a motion for sanctions on this, given the undisputed facts in this case, which was a willful delay and a willful violation.
So I take it it's your position that even if a hearing was available, there was, if you take the facts that were presented by the claimant in opposing the motion, you would still prevail on the motion. The ALJ could still, within its discretion, decide to dismiss the complaint.
Certainly, based on the undisputed facts that were provided in the motion to dismiss, which was, there were several supporting documents attached to that motion.
Mr. Stratton, let's assume for purposes of argument that we agree with you about your interpretation of the statute. I'm going to ask you a variation of a question that I asked Mr. Engel. Even if we do so, couldn't there be a due process problem with the ALJ entering, which basically is a case-ending order, not basically was a case-ending order, without a hearing? I mean, yes, due process requires notice and an opportunity to be heard, but what in the context of a case-ending hearing is that opportunity to be heard?
Well, in this case, there were opportunities to be heard. A motion to compel was filed, which went unopposed. No explanation for why the discovery was already late. The pre-hearing conference was held before a pre-hearing administrative law judge about 30 days after the motion to compel was filed. At the pre-hearing conference, again, the motion to compel went unopposed. The claimant
Is there a record on that? Is there a record of what occurred at the other than the court's order?
Other than the order, no, Your Honor.
And he said it was unopposed, I believe.
The order actually states that the motion was unopposed. And further, the motion to dismiss itself allowed the claimant an opportunity to present his case, or present her case, regarding why the discovery was late. The only thing that was provided were allegations of an illness, no evidence. The opportunity was there on several occasions. Claimant did not take advantage of that.
Counsel, the argument was made that it has been standard procedure in these cases, as decided by the appeals office, not to have such kinds of orders without a hearing. Do you agree with that?
I disagree, Your Honor. In fact, the side case itself, I haven't reviewed it recently, but there were four hearings set, that is correct, but none of those hearings went forward, and there was no specific hearing on a discovery violation that eventually the Court of Appeals upheld the dismissal. And there are other ICAO cases that certainly allowed for this type of a sanction without a hearing being held.
Counsel, let me ask you, I know that Mr. Engel didn't raise this issue in oral arguments, but he did in his brief, that the claimant here should not be held accountable for not responding to the motion to dismiss because it was her counsel's fault and all of the delay was the result of her counsel's illness. How do you respond to that argument?
I'd first respond that the claimant as a party has another remedy that's not this court's responsibility to levy. I would state, secondly, that if the claimant got the relief she requested from this court, the party that's going to pay the price will be my client, who is now 5 years past the date of an injury that's an occupational disease that requires specific findings on what those duties were that she was performing to cause carpal tunnel syndrome. This was not an injury incident. This requires a medical expert to review the specifics of the job and look at medical treatment guidelines to make a determination. That possibility has been gone a long time now. So we would actually be the one paying the price when in fact it should not be. Second, answering discovery, the claimant's attorney in his brief makes reference to whether this was gross negligence or not, and I would simply state that that where there is gross professional negligence, and it has been found, the full range of sanctions may be marshaled, and that's from the Nagy v. District Court of Denver, the Supreme Court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Ingold, you have a little less than 2 minutes left.
Try to talk quickly. The date of the order dismissing the claims was January 17th. You would ask a question about that. As to why it would be wise to let the administrative law judge find facts, opposing counsel states that his clients will be prejudiced if you reverse the agency because there's never been a doctor to examine the occupational injury claim. That's not the case. I can point you to a medical record, two medical records in this case, where there is such a doctor that my client was forced to go attend, who at length discusses the occupational injury and whether it's related to the workplace or not. They've had that. So, but I don't mean to dispute or bicker with opposing counsel about the findings of fact. I don't think you can make them here. One of the issues in 843.301, petitions to review, which then lead to appeals and whatever, the orders can be set aside when the findings of fact are not sufficient, conflicts in the evidence are not resolved, findings of fact not supported by the evidence, findings of fact are essential. If they're not made, the order as it goes up cannot be sustained. In 843.201, disputes arising under the work comp act, facts have to be construed. They can't be interpreted liberally either in favor of the injured worker or in favor of the employer. It's a statutory system and derogation of the common law. The legislature has had over 100 years to get it right. And they're very careful on the process. You have to have a hearing to decide facts.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. And court thanks both counsel for your arguments. They will be very helpful to the court in reaching an opinion in this case. So the matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are